This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
It has been a groundswell, really like tectonic shifting around in the world this year. I decided to prepare a class that I gave in February on this, and I had to give in for Haley in Limud New York, and I had to give in my titles way in advance. And I was like, do you think Me Too will still be something interesting to talk about? Here we are. Pardes also, I've been working also with Lisa, who's our board member. We're doing a prophylactic overhaul at Pardes of our own sexual harassment prevention and response. Renee's also been involved in thinking about just making sure that Pardes is a safe place for everybody, and I'm really excited to be part of that. And when I sat down this morning after a year of Me Too to be prepared to re-prepare a class that I gave in the first time in February, I was thinking, well, what am I hoping? By now, you've all got ideas about Me Too, right? It's like we have some thoughts. So what is it that we're trying to do tonight? And I want to propose two things. One, it's just a spiritual act to learn Torah. And this is a religious enterprise to rejoice in beautiful Torah, and see how Chazal, the Chachamim, Zichronam Livracha, have anticipated many of the issues that we're wrestling with now in profound ways, and appreciate them. And that's a spiritual pursuit, a religious pursuit, and I'm excited about it. And the other is a political pursuit. The Silat Yesharim, Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, says that he writes, I mean, a classic work called Mesilat Yesharim, and he writes in the introduction, there's actually nothing in this book that you don't already know. But you have to read it every day anyway so that you can get things deep into your kishkes. We would call it top of mind awareness. And I think that there's the learning. So you're not going to go out of here and be like, oh, Me Too, I don't care about that, right? Like, when you're there, the end of the class, I can tell you, a spoiler alert, is going to be that we're against sexual harassment. I know we're going to go into something more specific than that. But in the end, we'll think sexual harassment is a bad thing, and you didn't need to come to this class in order to get there. But I do think that we'll be able to know that a little bit more deeply and more sharply. That the Torah gives us a language for articulating ethical thinking in sharper ways, and in deeper ways, and in more thoughtful ways. And I'm hoping that this class is going to be is going to do both of those things: both rejoice in Torah and help us sharpen the way we walk in the world. It actually started, the preparation of this class started right quite at the beginning of the Me Too movement, because one of my students came to me with a shaila, and I think it's a great testimony to my students. She said she was working in a profession that had these whisper networks. Whisper networks are these spreadsheets, basically, where people in a profession can write. The most famous one was called, never mind, about media men, right? Here's a list of all of the perpetrators in media, and you can open it up and you can see everything from awkward date to rape and absolutely everything in between. And they're unsubstantiated complaints, right? It's an unsourced anonymous list. And her question was, should I look at this list? And I think that was a tremendous testimony to her. And that's the question we're going to take tonight. Okay, should we look at those lists? Should we participate in those lists? What's the ethical standing of those lists? In some ways, it really speaks broadly about the Me Too strategy in general, because the Me Too the movement has been rooted in shaming. And shaming is part of, you know, so there's anonymous shaming and there's name shaming. So that's our starting point. I want to begin with everyone has a source sheet in front of them. There's a few more. We are, I taught this Mishnah, you could just do this Mishnah for an hour, and it's fun to do this Mishnah for an hour, but maybe just for me, so we'll just, let's read, who will, Shoshana, I know your name. Will you read the sentences? One, we're reading source number one, one, two, and three. Just to the word and, not including. Go ahead. Some of you probably know this Mishnah by heart, and others of you are like, what's going on here? Okay. For those of you who learned it by heart, it's where if we learn, you learn... in high school sometime, all right, for most of us that was a while ago, you learned Perek HaChovel, the eighth Perek of Bava Kamma, and it says, HaChovel b'chavero chayav b'chamisha dvarim. There's five things that you have to pay. What are the five things that you have to pay? Just so I can see who's... So just so you can get your juices going. Damage. The first one's damage. What?
Embarrassment.
That's the one we're on here. Excellent.
Rest,
okay? You have missed work, so you need, we call it now, safe leave, okay? Rest, yeah? Well, you said we started with damages. Pain, rest, embarrassment, there's one more, and that is medical bills. Okay, that's like the first one you'd start with, of course, medical bills. So when you, somebody who physically damages somebody else, okay, that we're talking about, beats them up or whatever, cuts off, runs into them in their with their electrical bicycle on the sidewalk, okay? Do not ride your electrical bicycle on the sidewalk. But if you do and you hurt somebody, this is what you'll be obligated to pay. Those are the five things. And our Mishnah is working through boshet, embarrassment. And it actually seems to have three positions. Let's assume, just for expedience sake, that one and three are the same, okay? But two, if you were confused, that's because it's confusing. Two, the position two does not seem to agree with positions one and three. When we're looking at position I'll just read again. One is gives a list of offenses, let's call them, harassments, if you want, that are neutral, gender neutral. They're totally gender neutral. And they come with huge fines. Okay, we're talking, you slap someone and you're paying 200 zoos. 200 zoos, very famous. What's 200 zoos for? Good for? For a ketubah. Okay, a ketubah is supposed to be enough for the average woman to live on for an entire year. Okay, your average woman can live on 200 zoos for an entire year. And when you slap someone in public, you have to give them 200 zoos. If you do with the back of your hand, so then it's very dismissive, you have to give 400 zoos. All of these kinds of things, the plucking their hair, spitting at them, these are things that don't hurt per se. They're just insulting. And for the insult, you have to pay 200 zoos, 400 zoos, and at the top of the list is uncovering a woman's hair in the street, and you have to pay your victim 400 zoos. I'm working on the starting point that this is sexual harassment. Okay, I can root that, of course, in the Israeli law is pretty explicit about what sexual harassment is, but just trust me, so I don't have to get up the lot. That sexual harassment, the Israeli court, by the way, ruled that if somebody says to you while you're getting on the bus, you try to get on the front of the bus, and a man yells out the front of the bus to you, "Prutza nashim olot me'achor." Okay, because I'm looking at Renee because Renee sued El Al, and I'm sorry, am I allowed to say that right here? For segregating her seating, and she met Anat Hoffman and made that connection here at Pardes. So we're very proud. If you say you loose woman, you should be getting on the back of the bus. That's sexual harassment, according to the modern Israeli law. And it's really very much rooted in what you see here, which is that uncovering a woman's hair in the street will cost you 400 sous. 400 sous, that's 2 years to live on, okay? That's a heck of a lot of money. And position two says something different, okay? This is the principle. It's all according to the person's kavod. Which is a way of saying, what are they saying there? How are they disagreeing? What? It depends on who you are, and therefore, it's a sliding scale, okay? Are we assuming that the 400 zoos is at the top or the bottom? The top. Okay, good. I am going with that too. Okay, if you are a person with tremendous dignity, then 400 social status, then 400 sous. And if 200, and if you are just a commoner, then maybe you're going to get less. Maybe you don't. Maybe you're not humiliated in the same way. Rabbi Akiva says, "What are you talking about? Even if you are poor, you are a noble person, right? You." We look at you as though you are a noble who has had a temporary loss in her luck, right? Because you are the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We are all princes, my friends. Well, those of us, some of us are princesses, but we are nobility. And even if we don't have any money and we look like we have no honor, we have been given tremendous honor by God. God's self. The Levinas makes a point of saying that you don't have to be literally the prodigy of Abraham, Isaac, and Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. That's anyone who has law and national destiny would fall into that category. That's Levinas's principle. What have we got here so far? First of all, we see that there's two positions. First of all, second, we see that human dignity is huge, okay? It is, boshet is that shaming someone is the opposite of kavod. And sexual harassment is part of that, okay? It's just at the basic, put it into the category, as the rabbis understand it, of human dignity. And you're insulting someone's human dignity. The halakha isn't necessarily like Rabbi Akiva. Okay, there's some discussion about how the halacha comes out in the long run, but the Mishnah adopts the position of Rabbi Akiva, and that's to me it's clear that the narrator of the Mishnah is adopting Rabbi Akiva's position and is giving it primacy. Yes, ma'am. Okay. Esther's asking an important question, and the answer is literally. But the meaning, this is a law code, and it's giving you a list of particular offenses and their fines. Now, obviously, shaming someone verbally will fall into this category. You'll have to decide, is it more like hitting someone with the back of the hand or like hitting someone with the front of the hand? Okay, it's also a form of public shaming of a person, but it will. But this is literal. If you uncover my hair, you will pay 400 sous, and we'll abstract from that to everything else. You'll have to. The rabbis will have to abstract, but a real amount of money. It's not like some principle of the matter. You should know that it's as if you owe me 400 sous. No, you owe me 400 sous. Okay, real money for real offenses. It's high. We human beings have infinite dignity. Now I'll get out the law, because this is where the Israeli law starts. And I like, to me, that's really interesting. So I've just been taking this, took the class. I already said I'm the mimuna. In Israeli law, every organization with more than 25 employees has to have an officer who's responsible for taking complaints about sexual harassment. If you're a smaller organization, then the assumption is that the director of the organization or whatever, you don't have to have someone specific, everyone, and their job is to enforce this law. It starts like this. Chok ze mataratu la'asor hatred. I didn't put it on your source sheet. I just put it out, pulled it out here. La'asor hatredah minit kedei la'agen al kvodo shel adam al chayruto v'al pratiyoto u'chadei l'kadem shivyon bein haminim. Okay, so the first thing that the point of our law for prevention of sexual harassment is to defend a human being, to defend the honor of the human being on their freedom and on their privacy in order to forward equality among the genders. I think when you think about it, it's really interesting because American law, I don't know how of course the Americans came first. We are great, but we were influenced by the American movement. The American movement, they wanted to create something about sexual harassment. They stuck it into employment law. You're not allowed to discriminate in the context of employment and sexual harassment in the workplace. Discriminates against, hampers the ability of women to function equally in the workplace, and therefore it impacts our equality and is therefore illegal in the workplace. But sexual harassment isn't broadly illegal. I mean, of course, it's rude wherever you are, but it's not criminally punishable on the bus in America. Here, it is criminally punishable on the bus in America. Okay, you won't probably take it to court, but you can't. But they did in that case that person screamed out the bus, "You loose woman, get on the back of the bus." Okay, that was a criminal, and the Israeli law declared it as such. So you see that this idea of human dignity, which is at the very basics of our Jewish law, has influenced the Israeli law. The point of preventing sexual harassment is to start with human dignity. Okay, now we got to go on to the bus. I got to speed up. I'm sorry. I'm going to start to talk faster. I'll put myself on 1.5. Do you listen to podcasts 1.5 time? 1.5 speed. I listen 1.5 speed. So I can. I hope you can too. There was an incident of someone uncovering the head of a woman in the street, and she came before Rabbi Akiva. Okay, so now that she came to court, Rabbi Akiva comes to court and he says, "Hey, you uncovered my hair in this." He uncovered my hair on the street, and Rabbi Akiva says, "Pay her 400 zuz." And the perpetrator says, "Rabbi, give me time," and he gave him time. Okay, why is he asking for time? What's the theory of asking for time? Okay. Either to accumulate the money or to appeal, to bring witnesses from the other direction. Okay, so this is kind of standard. You have 30 days to pay to pay the bill. 30 days to 30 days to bring contradictory evidence. And so Rabbi Akiva says, "Sure, have your time." But instead of using the time that way, the perpetrator watched her stand at the entrance of her courtyard, right? So meaning he knows what her daily routine is. It's like hiring a private detector. He sees her standing at the entrance of the courtyard, and when he sees her coming, he breaks a pitcher in front of her, and it's full of oil. A small amount of oil, okay? It's an isar of oil, which is 8 prutot, okay? Again, it's marriage. That's like a quarter, okay? We're talking, it's a quarter worth of oil. And what does she do when she sees the oil? Imagine it's M&Ms. What would you do? Okay, you lift up, I'm not going to lift it too high. You lift up your shirt and you start gathering the M&Ms to catch it up. And that's exactly what she does. Okay, she says, "Oil, that's amazingly good oil." So she immediately uncovers her hair and she starts to scoop the oil up and to utilize it. She hates to see it being wasted. And what does he do? He places witnesses against her. And he comes before Rabbi Akiva in court, and he says, "Lazo ani noten arba ma'ot zuz. This Prutsa, this loose woman, this unhonorable human being, I'm going to give her 4 zoos. How much does she deserve for this humiliation? What have I really caught? What does it take to get her to undo her hair? A quarter. Why do I have to pay her 400 zoos? I'm willing to pay her a quarter. And I paid it to her already. Okay, that's what he's thinking. And he said, and Rabbi Akiva says, you haven't said anything. Okay? Lo amarta klum. Hachovel batzmo afal pishenu rashai patur. Somebody who injures themselves, it's not allowed, but they're exempt from it. Acherim shechavlu bo, but other people who injure him, they're obligated. Okay, let's start to take this apart a little bit. This is unbelievably predictable. I just felt like this is how it starts every time. Okay, when somebody's given 30, when there's an accusation, you've harassed me. So naturally, the perpetrator wants to undermine the reputation of the woman. Judith Herman writes, after every atrocity, one can expect to hear the same predictable apologies. It never happened. The victim lies. The victim exaggerates. The victim brought it upon herself. And I think this is the part here that you see, right? Once you hear that said, in any case, it's time to forget and move on. The more powerful the perpetrator, the greater is his prerogative to name and define reality, the more completely his arguments prevail. Okay, and I think that with only the slightest bit of imagination, you can think about what happened here. He uncovered her hair, and then he says, but did you see how she was dressed? She was asking for it. And Rabbi Akiva says, forget about it. Even if she's willing to sell her sex today, if tomorrow you rape her, it's still rape. Okay, I just like to make this very clear. That's what Rabbi Akiva is saying. Rabbi Akiva is saying I'm sorry for the children if this isn't the human dignity is inalienable, and a woman has the right to consent under all circumstances. You can't, no one ever asks for it. And I'm reading a book now about rape, and a young girl is raped. Her mother told her, don't wear what you're wearing. And she wore it anyway, because she was 16. And she got raped, and she didn't want to tell her mom. She was pregnant, and she didn't tell her mom. And her mom said, why didn't you tell me? And she said, I was wearing that shirt you told me not to wear. And the mom said, just like Rabbi Akiva, you could have been standing there totally naked. No one has the right to do that to you. Okay? And that's what Rabbi Akiva says. Rabbi Akiva says, just because she's willing to uncover her hair doesn't mean that you are entitled to uncover her hair for 8 prutot. To me, I just think this is an incredibly inspiring Mishnah. We learn that sexual harassment is a crime, and it's a really serious crime. It's a really serious crime. Human dignity is to be taken seriously. The penalty is civil, okay? And I think that's also interesting that the penalty is financial, 400 zoos. Because humans have inalienable and an infinite dignity, you can never blame the victim. So from there, I'm inspired, and I could just go home from there. It's really okay, which is good because I almost have to. The Mishnah presents a beautiful moral, it's a set of values that we can live by in our day-to-day life. But there's also something else going on that happens in this Mishnah that's important. First of all, is to look at the justice system. Why does he set up 2 witnesses there? He breaks the oil in front of her, and he's got the witnesses. Why does he need the witnesses? What? Yeah, to prove his case. How did she prove her case? She must have also had witnesses. Okay, you can't hamotzi mechaviro alav haraya. The only way to sue somebody is if you have witnesses, and this, of course, that's what makes this Mishnah a parable in some ways, right? You asked, is this to be taken literally? In some ways, I wonder. It's hard for me to imagine that this Mishnah really exactly happened, because who knows how to who falls for this to actually uncover a woman's hair in public with witnesses there, right? So that means that in our modern situation, it's going to be so very, very difficult to try someone. And we like that, by the way. The presumption of innocence and the burden of proof being on the victim or on the claimant is really to our benefit, all of us. He hasn't gained anything, but she's definitely lost, right? What is she? She, in her, he didn't prove anything by uncovering her hair, by breaking that thing of oil in front of her. He still has to pay the 400 sous, but she's suffered again. Not only was she victimized once, but now she's victimized a second time, and this is pretty much standard procedure also then. Okay, and so that's where we start to come now, is to understand why it is the legal system. After I've told you that the legal system is beautiful, I've now proven to you that the legal system doesn't actually work, right? Because it's beautiful, the morals are all there. If you're an ethical human being, this is fantastic guidance for you. But if you want to deal with perpetrators, this system is not going to cut it. And you see that the woman's going to get victimized again, and the rabbis know it. So the question is, what's going to happen? Okay, you wanted to make a comment, yes? Oh, that's so beautiful. What's your name? Eva. The opening two pages of the Gemara are about eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, and proving that eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth is money. And the whole idea of it there, if you want, you know, like that's a month of my Gemara learning from 8 to 12 every day. But there, at the end of that month, I would come up with the, and the point is, you can't really, why does it say eye for an eye? Because you ought to know that you're paying, but you can't really compensate. Okay, so I think that you've gotten right at the point. But just the same, that's how we can punish, because you also don't want eye for an eye, right? We'll all agree that eye for an eye is not a good idea. Okay, but that was an astute comment, Eva. So now what are we going to do? We got to zoom. Now we're on double speed. Mishnah 2. That was a beautiful Mishnah. Now we're on to a beautiful Gemara. There was a certain student about whom there were bad rumors. Okay, source number 2. Okay, a certain student about whom there were bad rumors. Now, I know that these rumors are sexual because of the end of the story. The end of the story, he gets stung by a bee in his private parts and he dies, okay? Which shows that the rumors are real and that they had to do with sex. Okay, I'm sorry for this. This is what you don't get in school, right? They never teach you the juicy parts of Gemara in school. But now you came to Pardes and you get no censorship. Rav Yehuda said, what should be done? What are we going to do? Should we ban him? Let's put... And I love this. And they say, should we ban him? But the rabbis need him. Should he not be banned? But the name of heaven is being desecrated. He said to Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, so let's stop there. Let's just, why don't they want to ban him? They need him. Why do they need him? To make the minyan? For his insight, perhaps. Have you heard of Baruch Lanner? Okay, if not him, Harvey Weinstein. If not him, Moti Elon. All of the perpetrators. We have a lot of famous perpetrators. The guy at Penn State. Why did they get away with it for so long? Because they were needed. It's so easy. We're dying to turn away, to turn a blind eye, because the person is needed. What Rav Yehuda means is, he's bringing in the students to my baby drush. I can't give him up. Should he not be banned? But the name of heaven is being desecrated. Chilul Hashem. This is probably the most remarkable sentence in the thing, because what were you thinking? Should he not be banned? You're thinking that people are thinking, should he not be banned? Well, if we ban him, what will happen? He works for me. You've heard of non-disclosure. You've heard of non-disclosure agreements. Okay, this it. Non-disclosure agreements are all about, we don't want to sully the name of the organization, so let's brush it under the carpet. Rav Yehud actually says the opposite. He's like, wait a minute, I can't let it go because shame shamayim mitchalel. It's a chilul Hashem that he's out there doing those things, and I have to punish him severely. I wish that every Jewish organization would read this sentence and know that when you brush it under the carpet, that's where the Chilul Hashem is. If you bring it out and you punish the person, okay, this is something that happens in the world. Rav Yehuda knows that this is something that happens in the world. Where the Chilul Hashem is if we brush it under the carpet, not if we deal with it. And to that, Rabbi Baruch Hanna, so he says, he said to Rabbi Baruch Hanna, have you heard any traditions on this matter? What should we do? Rav Yochanan said the following. What is the meaning of the verse? For the lips of a priest guard knowledge, and men seek rulings from his mouth. For he is a messenger of the Lord of hosts. If the messenger resembles a messenger of Torah, seek Torah from his mouth. And if not, do not seek Torah from his mouth. Meaning, you can only learn Torah from him if he is really deserving it. I want to say the basic, you don't have to prove that he's a perpetrator, okay? It's, if he's an angel, learn Torah from him. If he's not an angel, don't learn Torah from him. You don't have to defame, okay, Rav Yehuda bans him, and I'm going to assume that Rav Yehuda bans him because he knows that what's happened has happened. But what the natural thing that happens when you have a perpetrator is that the world says, but wait a minute, he's such a good teacher. He's such a mensch. Nice people are perpetrators. Nice people are perpetrators. This is manifests itself all the time. So the fact that he's nice is not proof that he's not a perpetrator. So what you have to do is not learn Torah from him. You have to distance him from access to, he cannot have access to perpetrate his crimes anymore, even if he hasn't perpetrated. Even if you can't, right? He doesn't, these are just rumors. They're just rumors, and nevertheless, says Rabbi Baruch Hanna, if he's not an angel, we better find a way to move him out of that power of authority, which is allowing him to continue. Okay, Rav Yehuda bans him. In the end, Rav Yehuda falls ill, meaning years pass with this student under the ban, and the sages come to seek his welfare, and the student comes too. Okay, we're imagining a sort of deathbed scene. And everyone's gathered around, and when Rav Yehuda sees him, he laughs. And the student says, is it not enough that you banned me? Like, you ruined my whole career? And now you're laughing at me too? And Rav Yehuda says this. He says, I am not laughing at you. I'm not laughing at you. But I'm laughing that when I go to that world, I'm happy I did not even favor a man like you. Okay, I'm happy that I did not even favor a man like you. This is Rav Yehuda, my friends. Okay, Rav Yehuda, he is the number one second generation Amora. Okay, there ain't nobody like him. And he's the number one student of Rav and the number one student of Shmuel. Okay, he's the number one. And he says, when he sees that guy, he says, I am so pleased with myself. Why is he so pleased with himself? He's dying. And when he looks back on his life, what's his pride and joy? He did the right thing, even at this incredibly difficult moment. Right? This was an incredibly difficult moment for him. It was a test. It was his number one teacher. Okay? His yeshiva, there was no one bringing in the students like this guy. And he took action, and he didn't sweep it under the carpet with a non-disclosure agreement. And he's so pleased with himself that he's going, that he's patting himself on the back on his deathbed. I'm so impressed, and it's amazing. I'm going to take your question in a second. But what do I learn from this? It was only Rav Yehuda can do it. Okay? We can't be surprised that there's thousands of non-disclosure agreements out there. Because there's a natural inclination to sign a non-disclosure agreement to brush it under the carpet. Even then, we know it's shem shamayim mitchalel. It's desecrating God's name to do cover-ups. But it's tough on your institution. It's tough on your institution. Penn State was really, they were doing well. okay? Michigan also, right? They, all of these places that had great figures, they were afraid to do what needed to be done. Rav Yehuda was able to do it, but he admits that it was really hard and that it took all the strength of Rav Yehuda. Yes. Okay. I know this story is so great like that, right? Because we have this poetic justice at the end where he gets stung and he dies. And so I know that Rav Yehuda did the right thing and we don't know. And that's why I like to hang a lot on this discussion with Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, where he says, and maybe it's a little, someone that I respect very much thought it was a little bit of a strong reading, but I think that here, when we say, if he resembles an angel, learn Torah from his mouth. And if not, do not learn Torah from his mouth. Meaning there can be an in-between space, right? There doesn't have to be either you put him under the ban or or he's totally innocent. There's, because we all suffer from this thing called dissonance, basically. We have cognitive dissonance. We look at this person and he's so good and it can't possibly be true. We can't identify that it is really a perpetrator. By acknowledging, Shira Berkowitz says, by acknowledging a nuanced approach, a person can do things without being all good. Perception moves beyond the archetypal monstrous abuser, and we search out the truth in a person's sometimes bifurcated existence. A community may recognize the existence of both beneficence and malevolence within a particular community member. If an individual has violated policies, engaged in concerning behavior, or disregarded widely accepted halachot or norms for a given institution, community members need not identify whether the behavior itself is or is not technically abusive. Asking a limited set of questions related to specific violations in communal norms, values, and policies enable communities to employ shared language, avoid labels that can be divisive, and take steps necessary to protect constituents. So this is only a partial answer to your question, but the first part of it is, okay, I'm not sure that he's actually a perpetrator. What I can say for sure is that he was alone in a room with someone who's vulnerable, and that raises my suspicion, and so I'm going to sanction him for that. I'm going to make sure that he can't do, that he has to hold himself, that we hold him to stricter rules because of that, even if I can't convict him of a particular thing. Okay, so now what if it's not really true? Is that what you're going to say? And this really comes up with whisper networks, right? Because whisper networks are anonymously sourced. So if we have, you know, we have a rule about eyewitness testimony. Not only do you need two eyewitnesses to convict somebody of a crime, but there is a mitzvah, va'asitim lo kasher zaman lasot l'achiv, that if he does something, if he is suing you, says you owe 200 zoos, and it turned out that he's a false witness, a conspiring witness, then he has to pay the 200 zoos. So he better be prepared to, literally, right, the person who accuses someone else of murder has to be prepared to, well, not murder, but someone else of a capital crime has to be prepared to throw the first stone. Okay, murder, he has to be prepared to also take part in the execution of the person. That means that the witnesses can't just lightly throw around words. Here, when you've got a whisper network or a rumor, which is what a whisper network is, you can really say anything. So how are we to treat that? Okay, good. I think that's right. Totally right. That's why I'm only halfway through the class. Okay, no question about it. But I'm going to do it in less than the amount of, don't worry. I'm not going to get through the whole of the class. you'll get home on time. So what we've got so far, Rav Yehuda must have taken it on the chin, right? Like he really paid a price, and he's impressed with himself. And I just to say, like, what an amazing thing this was. I put on the source sheet, source number 3, a question to the Rambam. I just to emphasize how difficult it was. I don't mean this in any way to defame the Rambam, The Rambam really takes the opposite position, and I think they're both legitimate positions, but he says, wait a minute, there's a certain Chazan who's also a Talmid Chacham, and he has rumors. But the Rambam says, no, you can't take away his job just on the basis of rumors. Okay, so I see, so even though that's the, and of course the Rambam understands that that's exactly going against the Gemara. And that's my way of saying, like, only Rav Yehuda could do it. Only Rav Yehuda could do it because the natural inclination was not to go with that way. Okay? Do not let the story of Rav Yehuda regarding the Talmid make you a mistake. That was in a special case because it was clear that he really knew what he was doing, and you have to be so careful. Okay. So what we've got so far, we've proven in through the Mishnah and Bava Kamma that sexual harassment is a grave sin because it's a violation of inalienable and infinite human dignity. You can never blame the victim, but it's really tough to prosecute. Okay, and she's likely to suffer very much in the attempt to prosecute if she tries it. And so then we saw that, well, if the criminal system's not, the court system can't really fix the problem, let's turn to the institutions. Jewish institutions have to step up to plate, even in the case of rumors. Okay, they have to. They maybe can't prosecute the person, but they have to take action to make sure that their institutions are safe. They have to work on a different set of proof because they're responsible for what's happening in the walls of their institution. And we saw the amazing work that Rav Yehuda did in the name of Kiddush Hashem, in the name of sanctifying the name of God, even under extreme pressure in the other direction of losing his great student, even in the face of cognitive distortion, cognitive distance, all because he wanted to protect the victim above everything. But given the negative pressure of leadership and the burdens of the proof in the system, it's not going to work, right? Because not everyone's Rav Yehuda. The situation in Penn State was a lot more similar to the real world. I know it's the real world, okay? But also in the Jewish world. That's how it works. So what now? So I want to spend just a few minutes on the imperative of action, okay? First we turn to the court system, and then we turn to the Jewish institutions. But when they fail us, and they fail us, what's going to happen next? Okay? So, source Ayala, will you read source number 5? You're Ayala, you're the only one here. Ayala was my chavrut at Pardes. I'm not saying what year. Go ahead. Okay, this source is amazing, right? Because Rav Yehuda pronounced the ban in the last Gemara, and I got it. Okay, Rav Yehuda is Rav Yehuda. He's the number one student of Rav, and he's the number one student of Shmuel. Okay, he's amazing. But who is, maidservant is a synonym for slave, okay? She's the slave girl of Bar Patta. I don't even know Bar Patta. Okay, and she's the slave of him. She's someone who doesn't count for a minion. Her eyewitness testimony is not acceptable. She can't even decide where she wants to be at 8:30 in the morning. And yet, okay, when she sees a child being abused, she jumps into action. And Rav Acha says, and it works. I mean, it's amazing that the maidservant, that the Ama de Bar Patta is allowed to put someone under the ban. The ban is like, of course, there's 100 pages about it in my dissertation. But it's got three. It's a social sanction. It's a curse. And it demands that you follow basic mourning practices. Which is why the teacher goes and says, do I have to worry about this, right? Am I really being cursed? Am I really under social sanction because of this nobody? And the answer is yes, you're really under social sanction because of this nobody. Of course, this is a good point to differentiate a little bit between child welfare and sexual harassment, right? Because in the realm of power and lack of power, the Shifcha has more power than the child, okay? And the Shifcha is able to save the child. So sexual harassment and child endangerment are not exactly the same thing. There's plenty, they're not the same thing at all. Although in treating them as crimes, there's a lot in common, of course. This, in addition to being about the fact that we all have to do something, this is it's about the bystander, right? Okay, I could have picked a different story, but where the victim stands up for himself, but I love this one because the bystander does something, and it's all about the bystander these days. Bystander. When we do our sexual harassment training in the fall, there's going to be a segment about bystanders and how when you witness something else happening, you don't always have to put yourself on the line like this slave woman did. Okay, the slave woman she could have gotten shot by, if this were America, she would have gotten shot by the perpetrator, right? But the, we can often step in ways that don't involve that much risk to ourselves and just say, "Hi, Shoshana." I actually in America, I was being harassed by someone on the bus and somebody stepped up and he said, "Hey, did you want me to give you those directions?" And he called me back to sit next to him on the bus. And I didn't even understand why he was doing it. He said, "You looked like you were really uncomfortable with that guy." I was like, "Oh yeah, thanks." Right. He's from LA. So they need to know about that more than we need here. That's bystander training. So we don't always have to take as much risk to ourselves as this woman did, but also, okay, and if we take that, we have the right to do so. You're not allowed to stand by the side. You have to do something. You have to be willing to talk about it. On to the next. Now let's get specifically to your, remind me of your name again?
Mark.
Never mind, I'll ask you later. from Limud?
Limud.
Yeah. Now what are we going to do? So you're allowed to take action. Okay, now we see that the institution, that the job of the criminal court is to take action. Then we see that the job of the institution is to take action. When both of those fail, everyone else has to step in. The question is, how are we going to do it? Because, I don't know, the Shifcha of Bar Pata was able to do a ban, and that guy, I don't know what happened. Whatever the curse was came down and zapped him. Okay? Or, you know, that divide, there was a certain way that the world worked back then that maybe isn't going to work for us in the same way. So we need something to do. And what we've got to do is shaming. Okay? Maybe it's a version of the ban. We've got this thing called shaming, either in the context of a whisper network or in the case of public shaming. Now, if it's true, okay, once you get it, if it's true, all right, that's exactly where we are. So now, I've got 7 minutes or so, and then I'll open it up to questions. I'm not going to answer this question. I'm just going to show that it's, because ultimately it depends. The answer is always, it depends. But I just want to emphasize, Michael, go ahead, you read. Right, Michael, what was your name?
Yeah.
No, Michael, I know. What? But you? Mark, sorry, Mark. Mark, go ahead. You raised it, so you read number 9. Did you hear that? Okay, idolatry, adultery, bloodshed, those are the things that you understand already that you're supposed to die rather than to do those things. You lose your place in the world to come. And Lashon Hara is even worse. Okay, go ahead, keep going. Okay, this is what my student was thinking about when she was deciding, should I read this or not, right? I was like, when I read this report, I'm being impacted by this Lashon Hara. Now, Lashon Hara is true. Okay, Lashon Hara is not defamation. Defamation is when you say something that's not true about somebody. That's motzi shem ra. Lashon Hara is when you say true things about somebody and ruin their reputation. So I could close the book right here and say, okay, there's nothing to, many people love to do that. Okay, so there's nothing to do.
even the Chafetz Chaim does not think that that is the case. He says, source 11. He has a whole clause here about deciding if a person saw someone harm his or her friend, whether robbing them, wronging them, or causing them damage, whether the one robbed or caused damage knew it or not, or if the person shamed them or grieved them or wronged them with words, and I'm adding sexually harassed them, and it became known to them clearly that the person did not return the theft or reimburse them for the damage and did not beseech them to forgive the transgression, even the person saw this thing alone, meaning there's not two kosher witnesses, right? They can relate it to others in order to help the one who was wronged and to condemn these evil deeds before people. Okay, to condemn these evil deeds before people. So to make sure that the person can't do it, and even just to say, we don't accept this in our midst. This is not appropriate. But they have to make sure to fulfill the following seven conditions. Here's the seven conditions. Obviously, it's not fair to do this in 3 minutes. They have to clearly witness it themselves and not hear it from others, because you never hear anything correctly from others, unless it's totally clear that it's the right that it happened. They have to take great care to give the guy the benefit of the doubt and really make sure that it was really a crime and that it couldn't be interpreted some other way. Three, they have to reprove the sinner first, gently. Okay, perhaps the person will avail himself and say sorry and rectify his ways. You can't go straight to public. You have to first try to get him to take it back. And if the person doesn't listen to him, then he should apprise the other people of this person's guilt, how the person deliberately harmed another. Okay, but when they do that, they cannot exaggerate, and they have to have only the intention to benefit for others. And not, God forbid, to benefit themselves or to taint the ascribed, and not because they hate the other guy, not from a place of revenge. This is really, really, really hard. Okay, there's a number of articles out there about what if you want revenge also. You also hate the guy, right? If you hate the guy, is it completely prohibited to talk about it because you can't possibly do it from a neutral place? Like perhaps you can't do it at all from that perspective. And then it says, if they can bring about the desired benefit itself without recourse to exposing them for their act, that in all instances it is forbidden to speak about it. And this is the most important, this is the part that's relevant to us, to the comments that Mark and what's your name? Leora said, the Reish Lakish, which is they should not cause the one spoken about more damage than they would suffer if the matter would have been brought to trial in Beit Din. Okay, now this is really confusing in the Me Too world, because for an awkward date and having your name on one of those lists, you can really find yourself, that's not a criminal proceeding at all. You can't sue someone for 20 cents in court for an awkward date. But you can ruin someone's career with it by putting their name on the list. So you have to be so very, very careful. So where are we going to go with this? I got to choose your own adventure ending. Okay. Let me summarize. We said it's a grave sin, inalienable human dignity. Don't blame the victim, but it's hard to prosecute. They're going to fail. So you go to the institutions. The institutions also have a responsibility. They can separate the perpetrator from the risk without punishing, or they can punish. But they have to worry about protecting, even though it costs the institution and it's difficult. But it's because it's difficult, it's probably not going to work. And so then you can go to the individual, to the bystanders. The rest of us are also, even if we don't have power, we have power. Even if we don't have power, and we have responsibility because we have that power to do something about it. And the question is, how are we going to do it? What are the means that are appropriate? So then we looked at the rules of Lashon Hara. It seems to me that there's many cases where Lashon Hara would permit this, right? This would not be a violation of Lashon Hara. I could have spent an hour also on this, that Lashon Hara, maybe it doesn't apply to someone who doesn't, Lo telech rachil ba'amecha, ba'oseh ma'aseh imcha. Don't go tail-bearing against your fellow. That's somebody who is behaving like your fellow. And if they're not behaving like your fellow, then they bring themselves out of those protections and perhaps you have to condemn them. Okay, that all of that's implicit here. So maybe there's room, but we have to be careful. Careful about our motives, careful about our natural inclination to exaggerate, careful about our careful about creating more damage than is reasonable for the punishment that they deserve. So here's your choose your own adventure ending. Source number 12. Resh Lakish was guarding an orchard. Okay, he had a regular job, his day job, and there was a certain man came by and he was picking figs like at the grocery store, you know. And Resh Lakish says, "Hey, sir, stop that right now!" And the man just kept eating. Resh Lakish said, "Let that man be under the ban. Okay, you keep it up, so I'm going to give you a ticket." He kept it up. "I can't. You're under the ban." The man eating the pig says to him, "On the contrary, you be under the ban. For maybe I owe you money, but have I become liable to you for the ban?" Right? Like, the ban is a serious punishment, and all I did was steal two figs. There's no justification for punishing me in a way that I don't deserve. Resh Lakish goes to the study hall, and the sages said to him, "Yeah, he put you under the ban. His decree of ostracism is valid, and your decree of ostracism is not valid. You have way overstepped your boundaries, my friend. You have way overstepped your boundaries." That's one ending. The other ending is Ula. He says, Nashim am bifnei atzmanhim. Women are a nation unto themselves. But what does that mean? What that means in its legal context is that there's a set of rules that women have about what's jewelry and can be carried on Shabbos and what's a scarf that can be carried on Shabbos. And women have their own separate culture, the same as men. But what it comes to mean is this. We have been siloed. This is, how do you say, Reese Witherspoon? Okay, I'm not good at pop culture. We've been siloed off from each other. We're finally hearing each other and seeing each other, and we're locking arms in solidarity with each other and in solidarity for every woman who doesn't feel seen to be and finally be heard. And nashim am bifnei atzmanhem, and it's the job of women to stick up for one another. And a whisper network is a way for women to stick up for each other. And maybe we have to, that doesn't give you full license to do whatever, right? But of course, I gave it a choose your own adventure ending. Both of them are true endings. You have to hold them both. But the question is, how do you identify this whisper network? Do you see the whisper network as more like women binding together and doing what we need to do to stick up for one another? Because if we don't, there ain't nobody who's gonna. Or do we see these whisper networks as a way of overstepping our boundaries and putting people in bonds? Okay, I'm going to take a few comments.
Yes, Shoshana.
The thing about the anonymity is that it's justified, right? Because I skipped this source, but I'll just point you to it. There was a source number 6, Rav Yosef. There was a strong man who was harassing a student. And the student comes to Rav Yosef, and Rav Yosef says, "Put him under the ban." And he says, "I'm afraid. I can't do it. It's too public." And he says, "Okay, so write it down." He's like, "You want me to write it down? Are you crazy?" And Rav Yosef says, "Go to the graveyard and blow it and write it down and blow a shofar," meaning do it anonymously. And he did it anonymously for 40 days, and the guy and the pitcher exploded, and he died. Okay, so there's room for anonymity. And there's justification for it because we see that the criminal system is set up to victimize the victim, to further victimize the victim. And if that discourages, correctly so. I mean, I just took this course about to be the officer for sexual harassment. One thing they did not say to us is encourage the people who come to you to make a complaint. right? They made it very clear that to make a formal complaint comes with huge costs. So since we want to put an end to this, v'nashim am b'fnei atzmahim, so those ways are very carefully closed off to us. I'm not disagreeing with you.
I'm troubled.
Right? I know that's why it's going to be hard. As I'm going to take, yes, but go ahead. And almost everyone, right? There's like people who don't. There's a lot of guilt, the person who doesn't file the complaint and then knows that they've then gone on to perpetrate that violence against more and more victims over time. The thing about the beautiful, I don't think I need to say anything. That was beautiful. Thank you. Other comments? So I'll just summarize as where we were. We've got a beautiful legal code that starts from the place of Kvod Ha'adam Uvrioto, okay, human dignity. And that has but beautifully been integrated into our modernly, into the Israeli legal system as it is now. Human dignity is not gender-based, infinite and inalienable. Everyone is entitled to consent. No matter what, it cannot be taken away from them. We cannot blame the victims, but we also, the criminal system, and we're happy that the criminal system assumes this, is set up in such a way as to let people who are guilty go free because of the burden of proof. And therefore, it's going to, when that fails, it's going to devolve on institutions to hold the responsibility to creating a safe space. That also is going to require a lot of responsibility, and it's a real responsibility. And if institutions don't do it, then it's a chilul Hashem. It's a desecration of God's name. And it is, and it's making people very vulnerable. But we know that even Rav Yehuda was proud, thought that this was his life's achievement. Of all the achievements he has, this was his life achievement that he was able to do it. So that doesn't excuse institutions, not for a second. The responsibility rests on the shoulders of the institutions, and every institution has to make sure that things are done correctly. But we can expect that institutions also will be not enough. And then it starts to fall on us, those of us around. It doesn't have to be just women. Okay, it should be everyone. The person who saved me on the bus was a man. Okay, but it should be that way. It doesn't have to be gender based at all. But women have in this thing called whisper networks. We also have this unique ability to look out for each other, right? Because here is something that we're not sending to the powers that be to get someone fired. We're just sending to each other so that you know not to be alone with that person, to avoid to know before you take that job what you're in for in that job, and you can decide, are you the kind of person that can stand up for it, or you can set those limits right from the beginning with that person if you need to. So whisper networks are a way that we have to sort of take care of ourselves. But we have to be ever so careful not to overstep, because it is a lot of responsibility. And it's a civil crime. As long as it stays at the level of nonviolence, it's a civil crime. And we want to make sure that it's not somebody's life. At the same time, we also want to make sure to protect the other person whose life it is. I didn't have any answers. I told you we weren't going to have any answers. But I hope what you felt was that there's a little bit of sharpening about the way we think about it, a little bit of a sense of how eternal these issues are, how deeply Chazal was thinking about these issues back then, and I hope that also a little bit of guidelines for us to sort of think about before we speak in either direction. What kind of guidelines should we have, both in the tremendous responsibility we have to resist things like cognitive distortion and cognitive dissonance and victim blaming and all of those things, also to be careful about the way we speak, which is really one of the greatest gifts that God has given us. I thank you very much for learning, and Shabbat Shalom.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.